This is Gaten the Mecha, the weekly anime and manga show where we take things one step further. I analyze everything from arcs to OPs to episodes in my wacky but enjoyable quest to make sense of all of it. Welcome back to Gaten the Mecha. I'm your host Jamal today, and in today's episode we are discussing Sakuga. Sakuga is something that I've wanted to speak about for a really long time. So what we're going to do in today's episode summary is we'll be talking about Sakuga and animation within anime as well as I can. I'm not an expert, but I'll try to give some good context or as best context as I can. Jump into sort of how some things are animated, kind of, and then finally talk about some pieces which I think really stood out in terms of Sakuga just across my anime watching career. And I'll try to give a bit more insight into the saga element rather than storytelling, which is what we usually discuss on the podcast. So as usual, if you enjoyed today's episode, if you have enjoyed any of the episodes you've listened to, feel free to give it a 5-star review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Helps other people see it and shares the love of Gaten the Mecha. Anyway, here's the episode for this week. That is episode 25 of Gaten the Mecha. It doesn't even feel like 25, but episode 25 of Gaten the Mecha, Understanding Sakuga. Today's episode, I'm going to have to give you a bit of a history lesson or a bit of a deeper dive into Sakuga in order to understand it and appreciate it. So in order to appreciate it, I think we need to look at context and what it is and how it's sort of evolved, how animation has evolved to where we are today, and then we can sort of go into some more modern pieces which I think express such beauty within Sakuga and animation. According to Japandex or Japan Dictionary, Sakuga by definition means drawing pictures, painting pictures, and taking photographs. When we break that down to the kanji of the word, we can break that down into ideas of making, production, preparing, and building, as well as brushstrokes and pictures. So let's carry that forward a bit into the background of Sakuga and animation. By 1917, a lot of the films, or some of the films which were made by these pioneers of anime, were made out of nitrocellulose, and these nitrocellulose compounds were really highly flammable, and that was what was used to outline the shapes of characters and capture that sort of motion. Although not the first person to make an anime, I would definitely call him one of the pioneers of the anime game, and that is mangaka Saitaro Kitayama. He decided to start his own studio by himself, as there weren't many people within this movement, although a few mangakas were going for it. So he was one of those people that decided to push this medium and start this wave of people moving into animation rather than still photos within manga. One of his works that I'm most aware of is one called Urashima Taru, and this is based on a Japanese folktale which is about how this fisherman has been invited to the sea as a result of saving a turtle from these bullies. Another one as well by Kitayama, the first generation animator, is Saruto Kani no Gassen. This is one about a crab and a monkey. This monkey tricks the crab into stealing their food, and then the crab gets a bunch of other crabs to fight them. It's a quite long-winded movie, it's about 3 minutes, and for that time, this was quite big stuff, because you have to consider that these are quite primitive narratives, but they take ages to make because they have to use this nitrocellulose, and it's made by one person, by themselves, and that's about 3 minutes of content, and this isn't done via a computer, this is done by themselves at a desk. If we jump about 40 years to the 1960s, this was an age of counterculture for Japan. This was a fight back against modernism, potentially the move towards postmodernism by this time. As we know, World War I had concluded over in 1918 and World War II in 1945, and Japan was gaining its sovereignty back from World War II since the Treaty of San Francisco. As a result, anime could take greater strides, as if we go back to first-gen animators like Kitayama, he couldn't really afford that much to keep an anime studio going and one which could sustain him. And with most of the studios destroyed at that time since it was mid-war, there wasn't much of an opportunity to do this sort of thing, and now in the 1960s, this was an optimal time for anime. One of the highlights of the 60s when it comes to anime is a production by Osamu Tezuka being Astro Boy Tetsuon Atom. This anime came out in 1963 and was made by a studio called Mushi Productions. The basic gist of the show is that this professor builds this robot boy known as Atom, who eventually becomes a crusader for crime. This kind of sounds a bit similar to some of the things we have today, and that's because people argue that this was one of the first in the shonen genre, or one made for a shonen demographic. In terms of animation though, this was quite fluid, and I think it led to sort of a greater fluidity within animation. You get loads of shot variety, you get this boy called Atom flying across the skies without it looking choppy. If anything, it looks rather smooth, and although it's still in the 4:3 aspect ratio and there were still ways to go, anime had evolved by then. It grew into something that was a lot more competent. We get all these different shots, we get point of view shots, we get zoom shots. It's as if anime was sort of recognizing that the camera exists, and there was a greater interest within cinematography and making something feel a lot more immersive rather than having a basic narrative and a still camera. And then there's one more animation I want to cover. This comes from 2013, and this maybe you might be thinking that this is slightly more counterproductive because we've been looking at anime from the past and you expect maybe some from the 90s or the early 2000s. However, this is an animation you can find this on my anime list, but it's one that you most likely don't know, and that's because it's an independent film. The reason why I really do like this is that it really personifies, or at least brings to life, these things and ideas on what Sakuga is and why it's so important. This film is called Nakanori, and it's by this animator known as Raparu. He's done a bunch of other projects, and he makes some short films. I'll obviously be linking that Vimeo in the show notes. You can also find him on my anime list. This short film shows us, or reminds us, about why Sakuga is about capturing moments, or it does show us why and what Sakuga is all about. Nakanori, meaning reconciliation, is a movie about two samurai that practically get into a fight, and then by the end their swords break and they reconcile because there's nothing else to battle about. Although it's not entirely long and it's not the biggest budget production ever, it's in fact two almost stick men fighting. It's about what it represents, I think, that's most important, and I do like this film. It is pretty well made for an independent creator, and what it's about is, I think Sakuga is about bringing those moments forward so it's the highlight. And if you go onto Wikipedia, you'll see that Sakuga, from that definition, is about key moments within a narrative, and I would think something like a fight in that sense is a key moment. And so that leads me to say that Sakuga is about capturing these strong and highly emotive moments, or high octane moments within anime. And that can vary. That can be anything from a character giving a speech, that can be a fight, that can be just be a simple line of dialogue that can be animated so well. It can be a funny moment, it can be anything. It's about capturing and encapsulating what one can consider key within a narrative. And so Sakuga emulates those feelings through frames and movement, and possibly even exaggeration. So I think that summarizes what Sakuga, to me at least, or from my view, means through some research and some look in history. Hopefully you're enjoying this format. It's the start of the new year, love to do some more, not documentary content, but a bit more factual content, introduce some history, introduce some philosophy, and still incorporate that within our analysis of anime and manga. So what I'm going to do for the rest of today's episode is that I'm going to be bringing up two case studies and talking about what I really like about them from a visual point of view when it comes to Sakuga, and also just discuss what I think that does and what they do for their respective shows thematically. The first example which I want to use when it comes to Sakuga and that sort of stuff is Ping Pong the Animation. I speak about this a decent amount in the podcast. I spoke about it for a decent amount of time on my decade review. And this is one created by Taiyo Matsumoto and directed by none other than Masaki Yusa. If you're not aware of Ping Pong the Animation, just get a picture of Ping Pong the Animation and you will know that this does not look like much anime you've most likely seen or any anime you've seen. The closest thing I can think of is Mononoke, but then again, not many people have watched Mononoke, so that's a bit of a weird one. Anyway, so Ping Pong the Animation, beautiful piece by Masaki Yusa. This is one that isn't within the norm, I would say, when it comes to animation and visuals, because it sort of embraces its own choppiness. And there is a notion or a stigma, I think, that exists within the anime community that choppiness is instantly a bad thing, and choppiness is proof of bad frame usage, as people would say, quote-unquote bad frame usage, or just low effort to animation. And I think this piece, this 12-episode piece, blows that completely out of the water. It has a similar choppiness to Nakanori. Also, check the show notes if you want to watch Nakanori, support Rapparee on Vimeo. One thing that I really do like about it is the fact that this choppiness exists, because it gives it a degree of authenticity. It doesn't feel overly produced. It feels drawn. It feels like it was put onto paper, and these frames are put in by one person alone. Similarly to the likes of the first gen animators, and that's not to say that there is no good cinematography within this or any variety, because 100% there is. If anything, I would say this has some of the best cinematography within the medium from what I've seen. But I'm trying to say that it does not feel over the top, and it doesn't feel as if there's someone out there to impress you with an amazing use of camera work and visuals and animation and see what I can do. It feels still to its roots, and I think that's important, because consider what Ping Pong is about. Even if you haven't watched this anime, it's Ping Pong. It's about table tennis, and this is a very raw sport. It's about hitting the ball to the other side, and making something exaggerated, yes, wouldn't be a bad thing. It would in fact be a cool show in itself, but that's another concept. Ping Pong the Animation is about the raw concept and essence of ping pong or table tennis. And so doing something that's over the top, I don't think would match. There are times of exaggeration, but that is done with intent. But overall, I would say that Ping Pong's animations are made to feel as if you're within the game of ping pong and not within something that's more than ping pong throughout most of the series. Throughout this series, the camera does a lot of work. I said this for a few anime, I said this for Attack on Titan, I said this for Vinland Saga, and I would say that almost each anime, not even just those two, but every anime has a different usage of the camera. The camera doesn't feel like the same camera within every anime, unless if we go back to the first generation, I think that might be the case. But as far as modern anime today, or even post-modern anime if you want to discuss it like that, it's unique in how it delivers its shots. One of the main people we can credit for this beautiful camera work and animated work within Ping Pong the Animation, although not the only one, is Yasunori Miyazawa. From the work I've seen from him within the series, it's really close to detail, and it's about the details. He pays a lot of attention to size when moving the camera, and although that is obviously backed up by increasing the size of some characters, this is kind of contradicting what I was saying a bit before, but oh well. It's about paying attention to what's in the frame. So if we go towards the end of this series, Ping Pong has this massive face-off between two friends. I'm not going to dive into spoilers, but it's a match between two friends who have known each other for almost the entirety of their table tennis careers. They're in this face-off, it's in black and white, and although the raw essence of ping pong is within this scene, it's about their personalities as well, and Miyazawa pays attention to that by morphing the camera and their sizes at the same time while they're playing off, because there's more to focus on than simply the ball going from one side to another. It's about their personalities, it's about who they are as people, as opposed to just the game. And so that is complemented by this shifting camera that goes from left to right, and the sizes of these people increase as the camera moves closer and away. Sometimes this is used intentionally for the sake of providing a view of advantage, or showing that one character has almost an advantage over another. That isn't really done here, but it kind of, you could argue that maybe it shows that they have an equal advantage, as sometimes one gets bigger, one gets smaller, the camera moves towards one, it moves towards the other, it's that sort of thing. But it's a really dynamic shot, and Ping Pong loves these dynamic shots throughout. We see this with characters like Kazuma and Kong Wang, as well as Peko and Smile, Smile being his nickname. We see that with those characters as well, because they're these big personalities that deserve to be shone on, or the light deserves to be shone on them visually as well. So there's this one shot where we almost see this dragon emerge out of Kazuma, this very aggressive and focused character, aggressive in the right way, sort of hungry for success, and that reminds me of DJ Khaled. He in fact looks a bit like DJ Khaled. Anyway, he goes out of his way to be successful and does everything in his power to do so, and we see this dragon emerge out of him when he's playing somebody else. Visually, that looks amazing because it matches the show thematically, and that's something I think is important. I know I'm rambling a bit here, but the synergy between thematics and visuals is super important. So just to link everything together here, thematically, the show at its heart is about ping pong, and that is done visually, or is matched visually by the raw essence of the visuals or the animation. It's animated rather choppily in a good way. It's done using cross-cutting and panels to show play-by-play that meets the raw essence of ping pong, and also it feels raw. It doesn't feel overly produced. Then we take that further to these sort of personified or exaggerated parts of the show. So animating for size and all of that, the dragons and these creatures, although not all creatures, we have, say, the hero for Smile. Those things are done for the sake of meeting these individual personas. So the show is made visually, and the image of the hero, the image of the dragon is done to meet this idea that each person has their own personality and their own approach and spin on ping pong as a game. That kind of summarizes what I'm trying to say. I know sometimes I sound a bit like a conspiracist, but that is what I mean. Thematics and visuals are met and combined together for something really succinct, and not something where, you know, it's pretty, but there's almost quote-unquote no substance, or the reverse, where there are strong themes, but it doesn't really work visually. People don't usually say that, and Ping Pong does not let that happen. Just two more things I want to touch on before we move on to our next case study. I think I understand a bit more, as you can tell. One of them is these lines in motion, and I really like these. They just make it feel more active for something that's drawn, because, you know, when something's drawn and you have lines, they're usually still. But when these lines are in motion, it feels like they're almost constantly engaged within battle, and battle being ping pong. Everything does feel active, and for a sports anime, this is really important to capture. You don't want your sport to feel bland, you want it to feel dramatic and cinematic. And so I think the lines that are constantly moving are really good for portraying this. Also, just some evidence of growing and tailored cinematography. I think that's something I should coin. Tailored cinematography. It's cinematography and animation and those sorts of things that match up with the nature of the show. So one of them I want to talk about very briefly is this transition between the ball. So the ball would come into the camera in some scenes, and then you would switch to the other person while the ball is in the camera. So it's a nice transition. It's quite seamless as well, because as the ball passes over the net and moves towards the camera is placed at the net. As the ball approaches, then there's a switch to the other person while the ball's approaching them, and vice versa. It's just proof that things are made also not just for the sake of capturing the show or capturing the match, but also it's also good at adapting to the situation. And it's really just creative ways, inventive ways of making a story, or at least making matches and competition feel really alive and interesting. My second case study is Mob Psycho 100, more specifically Mob Psycho 102. I speak about this one a decent amount on the podcast as well. However, I think it's worth a lot of merit, and that's why I want to speak about it today. Again, I can't mention everybody on the list of people who've done some beautiful work for this anime, as they have, but I can mention the animation director. So that is Yuzuru Tajikawa, as well as one who produced this narrative. Mob and Mob 2 are very ambitious in how they animate, and similarly to Ping Pong, I think there are some similarities in what they do thematically to match its visuals. One which I'll just say right now is how they have that drawn style, but it's not a drawn style for the sake of it looking raw. If anything, I think it's the drawn style for it to look wacky and almost exaggerated this time, and that's utilized within its fight scenes. So if we take the Shimazaki fights of Mob 2, the style works so well for it because everything looks over the top when someone smashes someone into a building, or when someone throws someone from the sky right to the ground, I guess. It looks over the top, it doesn't look too real, so you kind of get that level of detachment between the fight, but it also just gives way to doing some crazy things and actions. If we talk a bit about the camera and what the camera is doing, because that is probably one of the most important parts here. I love how the camera doesn't give any of the characters, if we take the Shimazaki fight, or even if we go back to Mob 1 and we look at the 7th Division arc, we have so many characters on screen at the same time, so many fights going on, even if it's say 1v5. Or 4v4, something like that. We have so many things going on at once, but the camera is able to not give, say, one person too much credit. And that's a good thing. You'd maybe consider, why don't we give the protagonist more light? But this is an effort of espers. This isn't a fight of mob versus one person or mob versus five people. It's a squad versus a squad, or a squad versus one person, which maybe it's some form of antagonist if we take Shimazaki, as I've said. It's about that rather than protagonist focused on a squad fight or one person focused on a bunch of side characters. It's the entire squad is captured equally. Maybe mathematically, I haven't calculated screen time to say it's directly equal, but it feels as if each character gets their time to shine within this fight, and the teamwork within them is done to perfection. The shot types also make it seem as if there is more than what is going on, or at least more than what you think is going on. So, although we do have these massive Esper fights within the World Domination arc, and even the Keiji Mogami arc, there is loads going on screen, but the camera makes it feel as if there is more going on. And I'll go back to my classic example of the Shimazaki fight, which I've mentioned like 10 times already, and it's a team fight, so, or at least a team versus one person, this person being massively quote-unquote overpowered. And the way the camera is, it's moving all over the place. So when someone gets swung, there's a POV shot of a gun as someone's trying to shoot Shimazaki from a rooftop, and then that kind of switches because they get found out, they get punched out. There is loads going on, but it feels eventful. There's no shot that goes on for too long. If it goes on for too long, it's for the sake of exaggerating how strong Shimazaki is. Again, that's kind of that synergy that we've been discussing in today's episode. It's making the visuals work for the themes of the show. And it's as if Mob knew that's what I was looking for, and it does that with full force. If I'm more close to Sakuga, because I know I'm getting a bit into more cinematography, I might as well call this cinematography and Sakuga, but if we're keeping it strictly to Sakuga, I think Mob Psycho's best moments is its use of impact frames. And what impact frames are, basically, I'm not an animator here. I wish I was, but I'm not. I'm not really that good at drawing anymore. Anyway, so impact frames are basically these frames inserted within animation that are used to sort of exaggerate emotion or some form of impact. It's kind of hard to explain. So if you have looked at the works of Nakamura before, you would know that he's probably one of the most famous people who uses impact frames. And I'm sure that he's even used them within Mob Psycho 100 before. A good example, I would say, is if you look back at the OP or the opening for Mob Psycho 100, you see an explosion sort of Mob, and you get that one shot of painted, it's used with brushes. It's just this black and white look at Mob, but that is, if you sort of cut that down to one split second, it's that one black and white shot that makes the transformation also more cool, because it's as if you're in this one state between the transition. It doesn't feel like a flash of light with nothing in it and he's something else. If anything, it looks like this transition phase, and it looks really beautiful and really raw because it's in black and white. It uses brushes. That's used for explosions as well within this show. There's that part in the Big Cleanup Arc, the main fight of the Big Cleanup Arc, if anything, that's about episode I believe, if I'm getting it right, 7 to 9 or 6 to 9, something like that. Those are used the hell out of in a good way. We get those massive explosions. I was reading something where people thought that Mob Psycho's animations are overdone, and I agree, kind of, but it's a good thing. I think if we move back to this thing that I've been pushing throughout today's episode on themes working for visuals and visuals working for themes, that is kind of what's trying to be expressed. It's Mob or Shigeo being this amazingly strong character when he harnesses his emotions, or at least when his emotions go out of the roof or shoot through the roof. He is amazingly strong to extent where it's almost overkill. Like, it wasn't necessary to be that strong. The Sakuga works for that. Those impact frames, Nakamura's use of explosions, he loves explosions a lot and makes those look really good as well. Also, like, the blockiness of, or the chunks of when things explode as well, he loves that. All of those, I think, contribute to that notion that this is a character that shouldn't be messed with, and a character that is, I might as well just say it, overpowered. He doesn't belong in this league of strength when it comes to that fight. Although I'm getting quite into details, the thing I like about Mob Psycho 100 too when it comes to visuals is just, it's not really the nitty gritty I'm massively a fan of, and that's not to say I'm not a fan of it, but it's not really that, it's just overall, it's so consistent in its visuals, and how it handles everything is done so well. There's not really one thing I'd say, maybe this wasn't as good as this part when it comes to visuals. It's an entirely cohesive piece. I spoke about this idea of consistency when it comes to FMA Brotherhood on the MHA Cult, the State of Shonen, back in episode 9. I went on that tangent on these other shonens and how they use structure and visuals and how consistent they are. That consistency, I think, can apply to Sakuga and can be applied to Mob Psycho. It's entirely consistent. There aren't gaps within its armor. There are no holes within its armor. It's entirely consistent in its visuals. And that's why I respect it. You know, you don't feel like there are drop-offs, even though I wouldn't believe that Mob would have parts where it's maybe not so good because of this, not really not so good, but the parts which obviously aren't as high impact. But even on the parts that aren't fights or amazing conflicts, they are still done wackily in a good way. They are still done with intention. And even the first episode looks beautiful when we get that connection between Shigeo and that other girl, although it's an anti-climax in the end, kind of, although we already know by that part, but it's still, it's making things feel interesting no matter where you are. And that's why I push back on saying sometimes that, you know, the fight scene is the only thing that matters, because it's not. And some things can be done so well visually that have nothing to do with the conflict, because the conflict isn't the only place to animate, or it's not the only part that matters when it comes to animation. So just to summarize Mob, I went a bit on a tangent there as well. This quite a tangent to the episode, but anyway, I think there's such a talented team behind Mob Psycho 102 and Mob Psycho 101. The entire team is so focused on making everything look beautiful, and nothing feels out of place. Everything feels the same in a good way. Nothing feels like it's... There are some standout moments, don't get me wrong, but there are no drops where I'm kind of like, oh, it's this again, or maybe that's not so good. It feels cohesive and fluid, and that is why I like it so much. Before we wrap up today's episode, let's go to the In The Moment segment for this week. Let's just talk about what I've been reading and watching as of recent. If you are on Twitter, you would know that I posted this thing where I said, I've posted two things on Twitter. I might as well talk a bit about Twitter in this segment today. There was one thing I posted on Twitter on Christmas where, I think it was the day before. I think it was Christmas Eve. I don't remember. I said something about how I'm going to use Christmas to bulk record. And if you are on Twitter, you would therefore know, or if you're paying attention, you would know that this is basically being recorded right after my Battle of the Trost District arc episode. Sorry to break the illusion, but I just found that kind of funny. And so that means I haven't had a week separation. There are still some different things I want to discuss, more from this week than anything. But I just wanted to break that illusion. I thought that was funny. And second thing, just on Twitter, I don't know why I posted this. I saw Bleach trending because Yonku, if you don't know Yonku, just guy that gives information on anime stuff. I don't know how he does it, but he does it somehow. Anyway, he posted something on how Bleach is trending, and then I checked it and it was trending. And then I just decided to make this random meme saying that Bleach fans are seeing that it's trending, but they know it's not coming back. And now it's gone like 100 likes, I think. That was pretty cool. So Twitter, that was a bit of a Twitter plug for you guys. Feel free to check that out. We're a growing community and it's really fun as well. You can message me, talk about the episode. I post when the episodes go up. Anyway, in the moment. So what have I been reading and watching this week? First thing I want to discuss, not much because I haven't read too much of it, but one thing that I've decided to be more focused on is the Marley arc of Attack on Titan. So I'm reading the manga at the moment. I'm just picking up from where season 3 left off, mostly for the sake of analysis. And I kind of want to be ahead of the game before final season because I think it will change my analysis a bit. And it means that we can look at final season in terms of anime and we can break down the arcs being Marley and final as well, which will be pretty cool to do. At the moment, it's interesting. I need to spend more time to gauge it and understand it a bit more. The conflict between the two sides, you kind of just jump right into it. So as soon as the Shigonshina arc ends, it's kind of like, welcome to this new world where this conflict took place. Understand it. So I'm kind of a bit like, whoa, what's going on? It's a bit of a berserk situation where when you enter the first chapter of Berserk, you're like, okay. Because I'm not going to say what actually happens with the first panel of Berserk, but the first panel of Berserk is kind of, it starts messed up already, and you should kind of know Berserk is messed up in a good way. Although this isn't messed up per se, it's quite whack when you enter. So interesting beginning. I'm not going to like just drop it because I don't understand it at the moment or don't fully understand it. However, I do need to take a bit more time to just feel it a bit more and absorb what's going on. And now for the second part, there's another manga I've decided to read, and that is Koibana Onsen. It's like a mix of harem and borderline H. I don't know why I've been into reading borderline H as of recently. It's just kind of interesting. It's just something that is a good escape from all these, from Berserk, basically. Berserk is making me scared and conspiracist-like, so it's nice to have a nice escape from something like Berserk and all these other things. That's kind of why I watch harem as well. It's just something that, you know, something dark isn't really going to happen. It's not like, oh, the character deaths at the end of this season were bad, man. You don't have to say that when a harem happens. No one dies. If anything, the most that has happened is a parent has already died, or maybe someone's relative dies, but it's nothing like someone killed this person in this harem anime, unless it's a really whack harem anime. So Koibana Onsen seems to be like this marriage idea, so the cover teases this marriage between one of three. So I'm thinking kind of maybe something more like Masamune's Revenge, although it doesn't seem to be a revenge story. The premise of the story is that this person is broken up with their girlfriend, and then their girlfriend comes back to this, I don't want to say brothel, because it's not really a brothel, it seems to be more like just a hotel, a really sleazy hotel. And then he says that he's in love with one of the people that runs the hotel, one of the three girls. And then, yeah, everything just goes from there. At the moment, it's pretty standard harem-y, ecchi stuff. So ecchiologists who are also haremologists, this is the one for you. Hopefully it gets a bit better though. I don't know what to expect, basically. Anyway, that has been the In The Moment segment for this week. If you have enjoyed this episode or any of the episodes, feel free to leave a 5-star review. We have a review, so that's cool. I had this whole thing, I was waiting for when my first review would come, and I really appreciate the first review. That was from Ash. Thank you for that review. And if you do want your review read out, and if you just want to leave a review in general to help people find the show as well, because that's one of the main uses of reviews, I would really appreciate it. Anyway, let's get back to the show and discuss some closing thoughts for Sakuga, I guess. So So I just want to make a few conclusions when it comes to Sakuga and animation, what I've sort of learned through research and by watching anime and paying a decent amount of attention to it. I think Sakuga, from my view, or maybe my definition of Sakuga, is that it's the art of respecting the small things, or at least it has taught me to respect the small things in production and the intricacies that are put in there, the nuances in production. I think it's a nuance in itself that animations and visuals are made to tailor for narratives. I use this example, I don't know if I actually said this, I think I was debating someone a few months ago, I don't know if I said it on the podcast, and it's how if we take an anime like One Punch Man 2, I think one of the main problems with it was that its visuals weren't really made to tailor for its thematics. So considering the high octane nature of something like One Punch Man, the visuals and the exaggeration and the crispness of those animations are needed because that is what makes the show entertaining. It's, although people say story is everything and visuals are second, and sure you can say that, but we can't ignore that it's a visual medium. And the animation, the visuals work for the themes. And with that not present, I don't think it was something that had as much impact because the motion just wasn't there. And I can kind of mean that literally. The motion just wasn't there. So it's those nuances, I think, that are quite important within animation and Sakuga. And on the whole, understanding or at least paying more attention to Sakuga, I don't think I'm a mega Sakuga nerd because I don't understand it as well as other people. I'll get back to that. It just makes me appreciate anime a bit more and appreciate what goes into the anime which we're watching or the anime which gets to our screens. It's cool knowing that these people went through all of that work to impress us, or at least impress me. Although they're not saying, let's make this so Jamal can analyze it and so it's so good, but they're making it so people can enjoy the experience. They're making it so people are blown away by the work that they did, and I really appreciate how much they put into it. And finally, one thing that I think is really cool is how there are bigger Sakuga nerds than me. I would say I'm a noob Sakuga nerd. I don't know if that's a thing within the Sakuga-verse or community, but it's really cool when you know that there are people out there who are going and breaking this down even further than I even could, understanding and liquefying everything to a frame-by-frame level. So what I've discussed is only the tip, and I encourage you as a listener to go further and, if you enjoy it, that is, to take a deeper look into what Sakuga is all about and animation, because it's something that's so beautiful and it's such a vast world that can be explored. Thank you for listening to episode 25 of Get in the Mecha, Understanding Sakuga. It's been a really fun episode. It was a bit more of a fluid episode to what I'm used to. We had some structure at the beginning and then we had a bit more improvised content towards the end. I was just talking about my love for Sakuga at the moment. So that was kind of fun. Hopefully you enjoyed the format. If you do enjoy this format, then tell me. I'm on Twitter, Jamal at GetInTheMecha. Also my email, GetInTheMecha@gmail.com. You can message me there and tell me your opinions. I'd love to read them on the show. Also, I just said one thing about I encourage you as a listener to, or if you enjoy it, to, you know, explore Sakuga a bit more if that's something you're into. One place I do recommend, Sakuga Bureau. Some beautiful people out there going forward and taking clips from anime and analyzing them as is, separating them into this massive database on Sakuga Bureau. I do recommend it. I should put it in the show notes if I remember. Loads of submitters, they basically put on these clips and they maybe put a comment below. You can also follow those people as well because they love that stuff and that's what they're into. They're always talking about on Twitter and all that. It's a beautiful community that I highly recommend, again, if you're interested to get involved in. So just to reiterate, that is sakugaburo.com. Anyway, thank you for listening to today's episode. Have a great day, week, morning, and whatever you're doing, just have a good one. Stay anime. I have been your host, Jamal, today, and this has been Get in the Mecha. The music in this production goes as follows. 8-bit title screen by Joth. Frozen in Time by Alex McCulloch. The LED Light Show by Alex McCulloch. Mandatory Overtime by Joth. Difference by Chasers Gaming. and Anomaly by Eric Medeas under soundimage.org.